Thank you very much, Lauren. And I'm really excited to be here to talk about the Institute of Medicine report and its impact on health departments, which is what I'm going to focus on. I think we've heard about more the national approach and what needs to happen, and I'm going to talk about specifically in states and other jurisdictions what's really needed and what seems to be working. These are the overall session objectives. I'm really going to focus on that first one in talking about the Institute of Medicine report and its impact on health departments and what are some of the challenges that really face health departments in responding to these recommendations and what are some of the opportunities that come from that. And throughout this discussion, I'm going to be using Massachusetts as an example to illustrate some of the issues that we're talking about. So in order to talk about state health departments, we need to talk about federal funding and what is available for those health departments. There, as people have suggested here, you know, there's very limited to no funding available for state and local health departments to address these substantial epidemics. And the funding that is available from CDC, for example, funds one adult viral hepatitis prevention coordinator in almost every state. And that is an average award of about $90,000, so that funds one position and absolutely no funding for actual services or programs. And there's a similar level of funding for the perinatal hepatitis B coordinators. The EIP program is the only funding that is available for viral hepatitis surveillance, and that only funds nine jurisdictions. The 317 Adult Hepatitis B Vaccination Initiative had been providing funding to state and local health departments for purchasing adult hepatitis B vaccine, but that was discontinued recently after the IOM report came out. And one of the other big problems that we have seen is that there are silos of funding. I'm sure people are familiar with this, but states will receive funding for HIV that may very well apply to the populations that are at risk for hepatitis C, but they can't use that money for mono-infected hepatitis C infected individuals. And so, it becomes really hard for health departments to prioritize what they need to do with the funding that they receive because it's so disease specific. So to further drive home the point about how little funding is available, I think everyone talked really well about the substantial morbidity and mortality that are associated with these epidemics of viral hepatitis. When you look at the budget for the National Center for HIV/AIDS, Viral Hepatitis, STD, and TB, prevention at CDC, you can see that they have about a $1 billion budget, about 69% of that goes towards HIV, and 2% goes towards viral hepatitis. So when you think about the 3 to 5 times more people who have viral hepatitis infections over HIV, that is really unacceptable. And this is not to suggest that there's too much funding for HIV. I think there, we know that the funding is not enough. But as was said earlier, when we have that level of funding, we can really make a big dent in addressing these epidemics. But we haven't been able to do that with viral hepatitis. So in the IOM report, many of the recommendations directly or indirectly impacted state and local health departments. And these were in all of the areas of interest in the report. In terms of disease surveillance, where the recommendation was for CDC to fund core surveillance in all states for hepatitis B and C, both acute and chronic infections, as well as targeted surveillance in a subset of states. There are recommendations for increasing not only identification of chronically infected hepatitis B patients, but also to expand vaccination programs, both for perinatal programs as well as for adults, and that would need to happen at the state and local level. We've already talked about viral hepatitis services and how uncoordinated and fragmented those services are due to the lack of funding and coordination at the federal level. And we really need to enhance and integrate those programs, and I'm going to give you some examples from Massachusetts on how we've tried to address that. And also, it was stated very well earlier about how poorly we've done at educating both providers and communities on viral hepatitis and how much work we have to do there, and that recommendation in the report is for CDC to work with the key stakeholders, including state and local health departments, to get that job done. But it's really important to mention that for all the recommendations in this report require funding. that we integration will save us a lot of money, it's a lot more efficient, and I'm going to give you some great examples of that, but it isn't free. So in Massachusetts, I'm going to use Massachusetts as an example, as I said, and it is in some ways a really good example and in some ways a really bad example. It's a really good example because we've had funding in the past that has allowed us to develop a lot of programs that we would not have otherwise been able to do and see what works and what doesn't work. It's a bad example and because we've had as much as $2.75 million, whereas most states have received no funding from their state legislature at all to address these infections. So, you know, we've been very lucky in Massachusetts to be able to do what we have done, and it doesn't necessarily reflect on what other states have been able to do because of the lack of funding that they've received. We've had a lot of funding, but currently we do not have any direct funding for our viral hepatitis programs. So first I'm going to talk about our surveillance programs, and I'm an epidemiologist, so I'm very interested in surveillance, but I will try to limit what I actually talk about here, although I'd love to spend the rest of the time on it. In Massachusetts, both acute and chronic hepatitis B and C infections are reportable to the state health department. It is the highest volume of all of the infectious diseases that are reported to the state health department. And we have integrated our surveillance activities into the general infectious disease surveillance system, which is a web-based system called MAVEN, which has greatly increased the efficiency that we are allowed to do that with, and has also automated a lot of the systems so that we are able to get information that we weren't able to do previously when it was more when actual staff had to do all of the work. So how our system works, I'm not going to go into too much detail about that because we just don't have time, but we receive lab results both electronically and on paper from on anyone who is identified as having evidence of hepatitis B or C infection, and that generates a scannable case report form that is then sent to the medical provider that is on record as having ordered that test, and then we hope that they send it back. And if they don't, we send another one and hope they send that back, and we keep doing that until we get something, but we often do not. And because we are not actually doing any calling or follow-up on this, it is very difficult to get all of the information that we need, not only to classify the cases appropriately, but also just to understand who these individuals are who are being reported to us, looking at race and ethnicity, risk history. We often don't get that. We probably have race and ethnicity data only on about 40% of our cases. And as the Institute of Medicine report goes into detail about, in Massachusetts, as well as in most states, resources are just not available to review or investigate these cases. The current case classifications that are recommended by CDC are really not appropriate for really understanding what's going on. For example, they don't distinguish between chronic hepatitis C infection as or past infection, and there are other problems with them as well that I won't go into. And it's very difficult to understand what the prevalence is in medically underserved communities because if people are not receiving medical care, they're not getting screened, they're not getting tested, they're not getting into our surveillance database. So we really don't have a full understanding of what's going on. We have not looked at how partner services work for viral hepatitis as we have for HIV or STDs. And most states have no funding to address hepatitis B or C surveillance. Because we have had funding, we do have these great automated systems that work reasonably well. We do have some information, I won't go into too much, but you can see when I mentioned earlier that the highest volume is in viral hepatitis, just looking at hepatitis C, we're getting 8 to 10,000 newly diagnosed cases of hepatitis C reported to us annually since 2002. This is a very substantial burden of disease. One of the other things that has been really useful about having a relatively robust surveillance system for hepatitis C in Massachusetts is that we've been able to identify trends that we would not have known about otherwise. Oh, my goodness. Okay, so 5 minutes. There's a substantial increase of hepatitis C among youth in Massachusetts that we've identified with the surveillance system. And we're now getting about 1,000 cases in people under the age of 25 reported to us annually. And the big problem is this, as Daniel Raymond mentioned earlier, is that prevention is really complicated with hepatitis C in people who are using drugs. And we believe that most of these cases are due to injection of heroin. We have integrated with HIV prevention programs in Massachusetts. However, what we're doing is not working. So we really need to figure out a better way of scaling up what we're doing for prevention of hepatitis C in these populations. Just to give you an example of what we're actually talking about with these numbers, on the left you see the 2002 data where most of the cases are in their late 40s and 50s. And then in 2009 on the right side, there are two different peaks of cases, and one is in the younger age population that we just didn't see getting reported in these rates earlier on. So this epidemic is changing, and hepatitis C is re-emerging in these young drug users. So I'm not going to talk too much about hepatitis B vaccination, but I will say that state health departments have done a lot of work in terms of identifying pregnant women with hepatitis B and providing services to those babies to make sure that they don't get infected. We haven't done as good a job at providing case management to those mothers and their household contacts, and we really need to ramp that up. And that's mentioned in the Institute of Medicine report, as is the need to expand adult vaccination programs, and we've had a lot of experience of that in Massachusetts and working with a lot of different community partners. However, our 317 funding is now gone, so we are not able to do that anymore, and state funds are decreasing, so we're not even able to purchase hepatitis B vaccine that we may have been able to purchase in the past. So our ability to do this is changing substantially. We have done a lot of screening programs, and really linking to what Karina Dan was talking about earlier in terms of community health centers, we've worked very closely with our community health centers for both these programs and other programs I'll mention. But these programs are integrated, so we've worked with what were HIV counseling and testing programs and integrated hepatitis C screening, hepatitis A and B vaccination, STD screening, and now with a new procurement, STD treatment as well. And we have 23 programs that are funded to provide these services in the state. Some of them are in more development, they're developing these programs, they were just recently funded. But with the 15 programs that we had up and running up through the end of June, they were screening over 5,000 clients annually, finding a seroprevalence of hepatitis C of about 11%. So we know that these programs can work when they're integrated. We have found that they are better at identifying people who are recently have more recent risk history and not so much the older cohorts. And I'm not going to go through all these challenges because we really don't have time, but there are substantial challenges that we really need to address. Having integrated them has allowed us to continue these programs despite the fact that we've lost our funding, but how long we will be able to continue to do that as HIV dollars also continue to dwindle is really uncertain. We also have medical management programs that we have piloted in Massachusetts to try to provide services for people who are mono-infected with hepatitis C. And we integrated these into Ryan White-funded HIV medical management programs, and this was, of course, using state funding because there are no federal dollars to do this. And what we have done is to use a nurse case manager to coordinate the care because we have been very lucky in Massachusetts to have healthcare reform. So actually getting people on health insurance to cover the medical care they need has not been a barrier at these programs, which is remarkable. But what is a barrier is having someone who will coordinate the care so that they can access all the services that they may need. And so this seems to be working. We've had some challenges with data collection, so we need to do a lot more evaluation with these programs. And we also really need to expand them. We're seeing at four programs only, over 2,000 clients annually. And most of these people are not on interferon-based treatment, but that may change with the new treatments that Dr. Muir was talking about. I'm almost out of time, so I'm not gonna talk too much about educational programs, but I will just say that one of the things that health departments have really focused on is this, and trying to get information out to medical providers and communities. And the Institute of Medicine report certainly recommends that this needs to be expanded. I think the integration of these programs can be very challenging. We've done this in Massachusetts, which has allowed us to maintain these programs and training when we don't have any funding to pay for it. But on the other hand, when you're trying to address multiple diseases in a training, you know, if you're talking about HIV, hepatitis C, hepatitis B, STDs, trying to get the information that people need without overwhelming them with information is very complicated. And I think there's also a real lack of integrated educational materials for providers and communities. So in summary, the IOM report does put a focus on the role of state and local health departments in addressing these epidemics. The funding for these programs is extremely limited. In the Department of Public Health in Massachusetts, we have been able to develop and integrate programs because we've had funding. And we found that these can be very successful programs and can make a big difference. And I think that really suggests that, as Lauren said earlier in this session, hepatitis C and B are winnable battles. And that integration will allow us for more efficient care and services and more comprehensive care, but it does cost money, and we do need to make sure that we are funding these programs appropriately so that we can make a difference for these communities. And that's my contact information. I'd be happy to talk with anyone about our programs, and I'm sorry I had to rush through it so much, but I really appreciate your attention.
I'd like to thank our speakers, and I'd like to invite them all up to the panel, and I'm going to open up the floor for questions. Questions from anyone in the back room there?
I think it's a realistic concern. I think it's probably community by community. I think we're probably going to see, and this is my opinion, I think we're probably going to see a change in the next few years about who treats a lot of these patients. The protease inhibitors are great, but they're making care more complicated, and whether that will take some of the private practice gastroenterologists out of the mix, who are important in some communities, is probably a major concern. I think in the first wave of this, it'll probably be more focused on specialty clinics and academic centers that have been doing this. But then there'll need to be an adjustment, and whether that means that there are more infectious disease providers that come forward. There are isolated examples of primary care providers who've made this a focus, but I don't think that's realistic to expect that to be the full way forward. In my clinic, I have to give all due respect to my PA. I think this is an ideal role for a mid-level provider if there's a practice where that is done. We have been trying to emphasize that also for people who are looking for new solutions. Where I see the good practices and clinics that do this well, it's a nice blend of physicians working with mid-level providers, and I encourage that.
And the federal government also recognizes that this is a problem, and we're hoping that some of the workforce dollars out of the prevention funds will go towards developing more care providers out there for hepatitis. I saw another hand over here. Young lady in the second.
This is among the best questions I've been through, and I've been to a lot of questions.
Yes.
Are you aware of any comprehensive sort of management kind of counseling, for people who are infected with either HPV or HCV? I mean, say, drinking, for example, the CDC advises that people with these, hepatitis virus.
Self-management resources?
Right. Or self-management counseling beyond treatment.
Well, certainly in Massachusetts, we have done very little with hepatitis B and chronic hepatitis B, in part because the funding that we've had was specific for hepatitis C. But, with the counseling and testing programs that we had, there certainly has been a component that we've trained all the counselors who were previously HIV counselors on how to provide post-test counseling on for people who are identified with hepatitis C infection. That certainly does include liver health messaging. So there, in other states that also have counseling and testing programs, have developed their own, and we all share them. So I would certainly recommend talking to either myself or any of the other hepatitis coordinators, and all of our contact information is on the CDC website, so we're easy to find.
Well, and I think there are resources like the Hepatitis B Foundation website. HBV Advocate has a lot of fact sheets for patients who, you know, so that they can do better self-management. But as you say, I think it's an issue of workforce screening, that some of which they've done in Massachusetts. We need to have providers who give very clear messages, and maybe mid-level providers are in a better place, can spend a little more time, or case management for patients with chronic hepatitis B and C, so that those messages are reinforced, they end up with good in-language, culturally appropriate materials that they can take home. It is a gap that currently exists that we would like to see filled.
Florida's done a really good job of giving those messages back to patients when they are identified. They're one of the few states that still currently does have funding, and they've done an excellent job, so they might be a good model to look at. Question right there? Okay. Can you stand up and speak up? That'd be great. Thanks.
I think it's community by. I think it's community by. This is probably a pass on a public health issue, but I don't know that you can just set a national strategy that's going to work. I mean, I think there are going to be issues related, and why I think the community, the local health departments are so critical to identifying what is the population, how do we get to them. You know, I mean, that strategy that worked in New York for hepatitis B, you know, was clearly much better than other strategies. You know, we're working, you know, I live in Durham, North Carolina. It's 36% African American. You know, I know that, you know, many of the African American men in my community are likely positive, but they don't come to the doctor. So, we're going, to not even to the community health centers, but to the, to the religious organizations and to other groups to find where these people are to get access to them. And so I think it needs some individualization.
And community engagement and education, because people just don't realize that they need to be tested for B or C in those communities.
And I would just like to add, I think that there are some fabulous models going on, in particular the Hep B Free campaign that I think a lot of you have heard about. And there are some similar Hep C screening campaigns that are happening or have happened. The thing that I would challenge people to think about, and in terms, as I say, of bringing everybody onto the same tent, the same umbrella, is to look at ways that you can integrate hepatitis B and C screening in the same places. African American men also get hepatitis B. There are, Asian Pacific Islanders also have hepatitis C. And I think that we need to look a little more carefully at the silos that we create when we have separate screening initiatives. That's not to say that these are really great programs. It's just sort of my personal challenge to the folks that are doing these programs.
And I think I'm just going to add to this for a little bit. I think one of the great things that Hep B Free has done, at least in San Francisco, is that they've gotten everyone on board that's a part of it. They've gotten the health centers, they've gotten the hospitals, they've gotten the policymakers, they've gotten the leaders on board. And really, that kind of collaboration and communication is where it's all going to happen. So I encourage you to go pull together a roundtable of the leaders in your community that can make this work and understand the challenges that exist in your community. So you have
I would really also say the perinatal hepatitis B programs, which identify pregnant women really well with hepatitis B in most states, I think expanding that to try to also then work with their household and sexual contacts is going to be another great way to try to identify people in a pretty efficient way and using a system that's already in place but needs more support to be able to do that.
The next three questions specifically for Dr. Muir.
Okay.
In your presentation, you mentioned immigrant groups, China, Southeast Asia is the highest risk group, but then you also mentioned Alaska. Is there, maybe you don't have an answer, but why Alaska?
It's just the studies just demonstrate a very high rate of hepatitis B in Alaska, and we've seen that in other native groups.
Okay. And then in the very beginning of your slide, you mentioned 80% decrease since 1990 for B, and then 90% decrease since 1990 for C. Looking at that, as I guess just listening to it, if I didn't know anything about the issue, then it would look like there were cured already. So there'd be no fund needed. So is there a danger or a concern in presenting that type of information? I mean, how do we know that? I mean, how's the data compiled to show that 80%, 90% decrease since 1990?
To somewhat answer you, I might not show that slide that way to another audience, but I do think people need to know that some of these strategies are effective. You know, if I'm with these guys on the Hill, I don't think that's the message that we would give that day. And I think there's a couple of issues in there. I mean, so some of these strategies work. So Hep B vaccination does work, you know, and does help. One, you know, I think you could argue, though, do we really know what the incidence is of some of those things? And I think, actually, the slide that Dan was showing about, you know, when they are really actually studying it in Massachusetts, you know, we might all be horrified if we really saw what was going on throughout the other states, especially when you're talking about, you know, 15 to 25 year olds. So I mean that in an encouraging way, but there's still some clear signals in some of these data that especially young people who weren't in the initial waves of HIV education are practicing and some at-risk behaviors.
Yeah, no, I agree with everything you just said, and I think the fact that our surveillance system for hepatitis B and C is so poor and our ability to ascertain these acute cases is limited to non-existent. In Massachusetts, we're getting over 1,000 cases in these young age groups, but we're not getting any more than, I mean, we get under 20 cases that meet the acute case definition every year. So the number of acute cases is really low because no one can meet it. And we don't have systems in place to get the data we need to meet those case classifications. So I just think that there are such substantial problems with how surveillance is conducted currently. And I know CDC is looking at this and is going to be making some changes based on IOM report and other recommendations. But I think that's a big part of what the problem is in really looking at the data that way.
I have one more question.
Can I just add that we very rarely present it as 80% and 90% decrease. We really focus on the number of individuals who are chronically infected, the number who are unaware of their infection, and the great need to meet those individuals with services and resources, rather than, oh, you know, we've done such a great job. The fact is that there still are hepatitis B, you know, infections in the United States when we have a safe and effective vaccine, and we could eliminate it entirely. That's really the message.
There was a very interesting finding in the IOM report that pointed out that the highest rate of acute hepatitis B is in African American males in the South. And so obviously that's a population that we're missing and haven't reached out to enough. So there's challenges there. And again, I'm going to agree that the surveillance system is not capturing everybody. And we still have this huge group of people who are chronically infected who need care and treatment today. So your next question, and then...
The 317, that's just the name of the cooperative agreement that states have with CDC for some vaccines, and it's 3 years ago they started an initiative where they provided adult hepatitis B vaccine through that, which they had not done before, and they provided some funding to states, a very modest amount of funding, frankly, but that came from the immunization area in the CDC.
So my question is, because the most municipalities are going bankrupt or cutting the budget. And then the CDC is only playing 2%, but yet they're defunding, and the states are getting less funding. So my question is, why are they defunding? Any people might
That is a great question. I was frankly very shocked that the adult hepatitis B vaccination initiative did get cut, given that that happened after the IOM report was released, where it recommends expanding adult hepatitis B vaccination. I think that was a very alarming decision. It's a real problem for Massachusetts and other states because we've built up a lot of relationships to start delivering these vaccines. Those programs were just getting up and running after 3 years of funding, and we're really making headway, and then they disappear. I'm very hopeful that this will change and we'll get the vaccine back eventually, but it isn't back yet, and those partnerships have disappeared, and they'll have to be rebuilt.
And we can talk to you more later about it, specifically why we do have an answer, why we don't accept the answer, why, but we can talk to you about the specifics there. A question in the front row here.
So I think one of the challenges has been to demonstrate. I'm very familiar with the U.S. Preventive Health Services Task Force, which didn't actually recommend for Hep C screening. One of the challenges when you have a disease that plays out over decades and has these different manifestations is to show that if we screen the population today, what are we going to do? And so I think that's been a huge barrier. There are some models that demonstrate this is kind of a no-brainer. Go ahead.
Well, for every dollar spent on hepatitis B vaccine, $14 are saved. So hepatitis B vaccine is clearly very cost-effective. But as Andrew is saying, the treatments are new and evolving for hepatitis C. We've just seen that patients treated for hepatitis C 22 years ago are not dying of liver cancer, are not requiring liver transplants. That just came out last month from NIH. And so the case for the cost effectiveness hasn't been made adequately yet. And we're hopeful that as this progresses, we can make more of a case. I think it's pretty soft, like screening for immigrant groups might be cost effective is what came out. That's the piece that I have for cost effectiveness of screening for Hep B in immigrants, or in Asians specifically. But screening for Hep C, the data's not there, unfortunately, yet.
So I think it's coming, and I think we'll get better. We had our Liver Society meeting last week, and actually there was a wonderful report that from the VA that I think will be in JAMA pretty soon, which basically demonstrated that less people died if you cured them of Hep C. And actually, on that kind of scale, that had really not been demonstrated before. And so I think that will, it came out of the Stanford VA. It's a wonderful study. But even that's once you treat them, you still have to back it up to, you screen them, you're impacting the natural history. It's a complex disease that plays out over decades. So it's easy if you are an evidence-based medicine purist, it's easy to say, show me the data. but that's what they're looking for.
And there's a Milliman report out on the costs of hepatitis C. It doesn't include hepatitis B, but if you look at Milliman online, they did a great report, showed $85 billion in medical care costs for hepatitis C in 2020. We can all stand here and say, well, it's $8.50 for an antibody test, and $200 to $300 for a PCR, and $20,000 or $30,000 for treatment, and it's $1 million for one liver transplant over the lifetime of that person. So, we look at the CDC's budget of $19 million. That means we can do transplants in 19 people. We have 18,000 people on the liver transplant list right now. We do about 6,000 a year. So obviously, we can make the arguments, but again, getting that cost-effectiveness data for the peer scientist has been a little more challenging. But we're working on it. Other questions?
Yeah.
Yes. Well, that's all the transplants. That's all the transplants.
Most of them are Hep C.
The majority are hepatitis C, but that's all transplants. Other questions? Well, thank you all for joining us. I know it's been a long conference, and we really appreciate it. We do have some IOM reports in the back. We have a few t-shirts left. If anybody wants a Hepatitis is a Winnable Battle t-shirt, call the CDC and ask them your questions. This is a great question about why was the funding cut. They need to hear from more than a few people, and we encourage you to join the advocacy movement. Call your policy leaders. Let them know this is a problem in your community, and you expect them to do something about it. Thank you very much.